A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how an ordinary person gets better at spotting deception. Not the TV detective stuff. Not the one weird trick you saw on YouTube. He wants to know what trained interrogators actually look for. The micro-expressions Ekman cataloged. Baseline versus deviation behavior. Verbal tells like overly precise denials or stories that collapse when you ask someone to tell them backwards. The pacifying gestures. The cognitive load cues. How professionals in police interrogation have intelligence agents, and that famous Israeli airport security behavioral profiling layer, separate signal from noises, and what lay people get wrong, the eye direction myth, the overconfidence after one documentary, plus concrete techniques someone can actually practice.
This is one of those topic talks where the gap between what people think they know and what the research actually says is about the width of a Grand Canyon.
Of course it is. Everyone's a human lie detector after watching 3 episodes of crime drama.
There's a meta-analysis from Alder from Raj. He's one of the giants in the field, University of Portsmouth, and he found repeatedly that professionals like police officers, judges, and judges don't outperform college students in controlled deception detection studies. Accuracy hovers around 54%. That's barely above a point flip.
54%. That's the professional baseline. So what are the professionals doing that still only gets them 4 points above random chance?
They're using the same unreliable cues everyone else uses mostly. Eye contact avoidance, fidgeting, nervousness, none of which reliably indicate deception. But, and this is where it gets interesting, some of the specific techniques do push accuracy significantly higher. The strategic use of evidence, use of roads approach, cognitive load interviewing, the behavioral profiling layers, developer airport security. These are magic, but they move the needle.
Let's start with what doesn't work, because that's where most people are stuck. The eye direction myth. Liars look up and to the right, or they won't meet your eye. Walk me through why that's garbage.
In neural linguistic programming on prominence since the 1970s that somehow embedded itself in the popular culture like culture tick. The idea was that eye movements mapped to different cognitive processes, visual recall versus visual construction, and that a liar constructing a story would look in a specific direction. Multiple controlled studies have tested and found zero correlation between eye direction and truthfulness. It's completely discredited, but you still hear it in corporate rod for training seminars.
The other one, liars won't look you in the eye.
Also wrong, and in fact the opposite is often true. Skilled liars know that the myth will deliberately make more eye contact come to normal than because they're managed because they're making their impression. If someone who normally looks around while talking suddenly locks and eyes with you like trying to win a daring contest, that's more interesting than someone in some glancing away today.
The first thing a would-be everyday sleuth needs to do is unlearn basically everything pop culture taught them.
Throw out the whole toolkit and start over. The real foundation is baseline behavior. You can't spot deviation if you don't know what normal looks for that specific person.
Which is why the Israeli airport security model is built the way it is. They're not looking for suspicious behavior in some universal sense. They're looking for deviation from the passenger's own baseline under mild stress.
Right, and I know we've talked about this before, so I won't rehash the whole system, but the relevant piece here is that the greener screen establishes a conversational baseline with a few questions. Where are you coming from? Who packed your bag? What's the purpose of your trip? They're not interrogating to give you one question. They're watching how you answer when the sticks are low, so they have something to compare against when the question points get pointed.
The moment you deviate, your pace changes, your gestures shift, you suddenly get more elaborate or more clipped. That's the flag, not the content of the answer itself, necessarily.
All eggplant workmen's micro-expressions didn't fit the same framework, so the optimist understood. Ekman identified what he called universal facial expressions. Fear, anger, disgust, contempt, sadness, and surprise, happiness, that appear across cultures and are largely voluntary. A microaggression is a leading inversion lasting under a fifth of a second, that leaks out before the first person can mask it. The key insight isn't that a microaggression appears in fear someone means someone is lying. It's that the expression often contradicts what they're saying or the emotional display they're trying to project. The wife says she's not worried about her husband, and for 20th of a second, fear flashes across his face. That's the signal.
Eggman himself has been clear that microexpressions indicate concealed emotion, not deception per se. You might be hiding fear because you're embarrassed, not because you committed a crime.
That is the distinction he lost constantly. Eggman trained the Secret Service and the NTSA, and his work is genuinely useful, but the popularized version, here are the expressions, now go ahead and get liars, is a caricature. In controlled control studies, even trained voters using Eggman's facial action coding system achieve accuracy well above single chance, but nowhere near the 90% number that opponents claim for human lie detectors.
The human lie detector thing is its own industry, and it's mostly grift.
I'll name names. There are former law enforcement officers who sell training to training programs claiming they can teach anyone teach about deception with near-perfect accuracy. When independent researchers test their methods, the result collapses. Alder Reed and his colleagues have been particularly blunt about this. They've written that the claim of these lies of these detection methods are not supported by scientific evidence, and that their demonstrated accuracy in rolling control settings is unremarkable.
Let's talk about what actually does work. You mentioned cognitive load interviewing. What is it, and why does it catch liars?
The theory is elegant. Lying is cognitively harder than telling the truth. When you're telling the truth, you're recalling an event that actually happened. The memory is there, you access it, you describe it. When you're lying, you have to start a plausible narrative, maintain internal consistency, monitor your own behavior, monitor the listener's reaction, and express the truth simultaneously. That's the massive cognitive load. Cognitive load interviewing increases that load deliberately to widen the gap between liars between liars and truth tellers.
You make the hard thing harder, and the person who is already struggling breaks.
One technique is asking the person to tell their story in reverse chronological order. Start at the end and walk backwards. For a truth teller, this is unusual but manageable. The memory exists. They can navigate it from a different angle. For a liar, it's catastrophic. They rehearse their story forward. Reversing it requires reconstructing the entire fabricated timeline on the fly while maintaining this consistency. The cognitive load skyrockets, and the cues, hesitations, inconsistencies, impossible details become much more visible.
I love this because it's not about reading tea leaves. It's about engineering. A situation where deception becomes harder to sustain. You're not trying to interpret a twitch. You're making the liar do the work.
Multiple studies support it. Britt and his team have run a team of experiments where participants are asked to tell the truth or lie about an event, then recount it in reverse order. Observers watching the reverse order accounts or counts were significantly better at identifying the liar than those watching the chronological accounts. The effect is real is replicable.
What about the verbal tells? The overly precise denial thing. I've heard that liars avoid contractions. I did not do that. Instead of I didn't do that. And use distancing language like that woman instead of their wife's name.
Some of this holds up. Some is holds for wisdom. The distancing language is reasonably well supported. Liars do tend to use fewer first pronouns and pronouns more passive direct constructions because psychologically they're just distancing themselves from the deception. The window got broken versus I broke the window. The contraction thing is shaking here. Some studies find it an effect, others don't. What's more reliable is the structure of the narrative itself. Truthful accounts tend to be messier. They include irrelevant detail, correct corrections, additions of memories, memory gaps. Fabricated accounts tend to be cleaner, more chronological, more likely structured because they've been constructed rather than recalled.
A story that's too neat is actually suspicious.
In the right context, yes. Real memory is reconstructive, strictive, and imperfect. A narrative with no false starts, no correct predictions, no... Actually, wait, let me back up. That's a flag. Not conclusive, but it should make you pay critical attention.
Which brings us to the strategic use of evidence approach. What is SUE, and how is it different from what we see in interrogation rooms on television?
SUE was developed primarily by Maria Hartwig and Pierre Anders Granhag at the University of Gothenburg, and it's a complete departure from the use of the accusatorial, confrontational style, which most people imagine when they think of interrogation. The classic American redacted technique, which is just widely taught to police, is honest confrontational. You accuse, you accuse, you pressure, you minimize the moral seriousness of the crime of the crime to coax a confession. The problem is, the redacted technique produces false confession at an alarming rate. It's designed to break the resistance to uncover true truth.
It assumes guilt from the jump.
That's a fundamental critique. As you eat, flip on, flips the model. Instead of revealing what you know of your front, we have your fingerprint on the face on the safe. You withhold that evidence and ask since open-ended questions first. You let the suspect's account develop. Then you compare their narrative to the evidence you already hold. The key is that you don't reveal what evidence you have since you have, or when you have, it. You ask the answer, and you see whether their story accommodates or contradicts the facts you're holding back in your back pocket.
If the fingerprints are on the safe, and the suspect says, "I've never been in that room," you caught them in a contradiction. But if you tell them about the fingerprints first, they'll just say, "Oh right, I was in that room earlier, I forgot."
And Grant research shows that just the guilty suspect is an SUE-style interviews contradict the evidence far more often than innocent suspects. Because innocent suspects don't need to manage their story around the facts they don't know the interviewer has. They just tell the truth, which begins to be consistent with the evidence by definition. Liars, by contrast, are guessing what the interviewer knows and often get wrong.
How does an ordinary person apply this without this being a trained interrogator or holding secret evidence?
The everyday version is to ask open-ended questions or years before reveal what you know or you suspect. If you think your teenage teacher was at a party and studying at the library, don't say, "I know you were at a party." Ask, "What did you do at the library tonight?" and let them fill the narrative. If they volunteer that they were in the quiet study room until 10, and you happen to know the library closes at 9 on weeknights, you learn something without something in your hand.
The listening for what isn't said piece. That's the other half of the prompt question. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means it's paying attention to the gap to the gaps in evasion, not just the words. A truthful person describing an event will typically include sensory details, emotions, and casual and textual information. What the room smelled like, how they felt, what the weather was doing. A deceptive person often strips those out because they're constructing the skeleton of a story, not recalling a lived experience. They'll give you the plot point, but not the texture. So when someone's account is conspicuously thin, when they describe a 2-hour dinner to date, they can't tell you what they ate, what music was playing, or anything their companion said, instead, that absence is the tell.
The flip side of that is the overly detailed lie, where someone tells you exactly what they ate, what their companion ordered, the color of the napkins, the name of the server, and the precise time they paid the check. That's also a lie.
It's the proofness of the account. Real memory doesn't serve up that sort of level of granular detail on a detailed man for every aspect of an event. When someone's story is a fact delivery system rather than a recollection, your antenna should go up.
Let's talk about pacifying gestures. This is the body language piece that actually has some empirical backing, unlike the eye direction stuff.
Pacifying gestures are self-soothing behaviors. Touching the face, rubbing the neck, stroking the arms, adjusting clothing, that people use to calm themselves under stress. The late Joe Navarro, who was an FBI counterintelligence agent, wrote extensively on this, emphasized that these behaviors are limbic responses. They're not under conscious control the way our words are. When someone limps and zigzags the register, or discomfort, the body responds with pacifying behavior to self-regulate.
The key, again, is baseline versus deviation. Some people touch their face constantly when they're relaxed. That's not a tell. It's when the pacifying behavior increases markedly in response to a specific question or topic that it becomes meaningful.
The Navarro's framework is useful here. Look for clusters of gestures of behavior, not in single cues. One has a pacifying gesture in just isolation, and nothing's nothing. A pacifying gesture combined with a shift of vocal tone, a change in blink rate, and a verbal evasion. That's a cluster. Clusters are more reliable than anything in a single cue, because it's because the selection looks through multiple channels simultaneously. The liar is managing their words, their face, their body, their voice, and they can't control all of them perfectly at once.
The polygraph fallacy in miniature. The polygraph measures physiological arousal, heart rate, respirations, skin conductivity, and assumes deception causes arousal. But innocence under accusation also causes arousal. The machine can't tell the difference between the fear of being caught and the fear of being wrongly accused.
which is why the polygraph is not admissible in most sports courts, and why the National Academy of Sciences concluded, including 2003, that the evidence for its accuracy is scanty and scientifically weak. It's a stress detector, not a lie detector. And stress just correlates with a lot of things that aren't lying.
We've covered microexpressions, baseline behavior, cognitive load, verbal tells, SUE, pacifying gestures, and a tour of what doesn't work. If someone listening wants to actually get better at this, not to become a self-appointed human lie detector, but to be a more perceptive observer of the people around them, what's the practice regimen?
I'd say there are five concrete things. First, practice establishing baseline instances in low-stakes settings. Next time you're in a mixed meeting or at dinner, just observe how each person behaves when they're relaxed, how fast do they talk. How much do they gesture? Where do they look? Do they interrupt or wait? You're trying to catch anyone in anything. You're building the skill of noticing normal signal. Do this for fun and you'll be shocked at how much you're missing.
That's step one. What's step two?
Ask more open-ended questions and shut up. Most people, when they suspect being lied to, start asking leading questions or making accusations. That is, teaches the liar what you know and give them the chance to adjust. Instead, say, tell me more about that, or walk me through what happened, and then listen. Not just to the words, but to the structure, the level of detail, the emotional tone. Let silence sit. People rush to silence, and liars often fill it with over-explanation. Practice reverse order first, or call on your yourself first. Try it with your own memories. Describe your mute commute this morning from arrival to departure. Notice how it feels when you're accessing a real memory versus when you're just trying to hold a simple sequence in your head. Once you understand the cognitive experience from the inside, you'll recognize the strain of strain and other more readily. Keep a ledger of your own history and be honest about it. Most people remember their catches and forget their misses. If you think you've spotted a lie, note it privately and wait for ground truth. A confession, contradictory evidence, something that something confirms or disconfirms. Most people never close a loop, so they walk around thinking they're 80% accurate when they're actually a chance. The feedback is essential. Read the actual research, not the bookstore version. Alder Reedy's Detecting Lies Attempts is the act is the academic or stop, but his co-authored paper Reading Lies, Dishonorable Communication and Deception is a good entry point. Paul Ekman's Telling Lies Tells is readable is grounded. Joe Navarro's Just What Everybody Is Saying is practical on the non-converbal side. Avoid anything that promises a foolproof proof system or claims that a single view is diagnostic. If it sounds too good to be true, it's probably a former off from Kellyanne in a seminar.
The skill underneath all of this is humility. The people who are worst at spotting deception are the ones who are certain they're good at it. The ones who are actually decent at it tend to be acutely aware of how much they're missing.
There's a study I think about a lot, but researchers asked people to rate their own lie detection ability and tested them. The self-rated experts perform no better than anyone else. But the people who rated themselves as average or below average, which were slightly more accurate because they were paying closer attention. Certainty is the enemy of perception.
Like adopting a feral cat, you don't grab it. You sit still and let it reveal itself.
Actually, a perfect analogy for the whole approach. You're not hunting, you're lying. You're creating a condition where deception becomes harder and harder to sustain, and truth has room to show itself.
One thing we haven't touched on is the ethical dimension. The prompt frames this as becoming an everyday sleuth, and I think there's a line between being perceptive and being paranoid. Where do you draw it?
That's a real bad question. The skills we're describing are morally neutral. They can be used to understand people better, people bored, and to manipulate them. The same cognitive load technique that the liars can also be used to use pressure into pressure in a person into a false confession if the interrogator is convinced of his guilt and just wants to break them. That's the read technique problem in a nutshell.
The other cast to be. You're using these skills to become a better listener, not to win arguments or confirm your suspicions. If you're deploying SUE tactics on your spouse because you're convinced they're hiding something, the problem isn't your technique, it's your relationship.
The research backs this up in a way that's slightly uncomfortable. People who are suspicious of just false, who assume others are deceptive, are not better at spotting lies. They just generate more false positives. They see deception everywhere because they're looking for everywhere. The most accurate observers tend to be those who default to trust, but they are sensitive to inconsistency.
Truth defaults to theory.
T Tim Levine's work at the University of Alabama, Stigma, Birmingham. Humans are truth bias by default. We assume honesty because most communication is honest, and social life and social DM would be possible otherwise. People who override that bias too aggressively don't get more accurate. They just get more isolated.
Which loops back to the Israeli airport model in an interesting way. That system isn't suspicious of everyone. It's remarkably efficient precisely because it uses a quick baseline assessment to clear the vast majority of passengers and focuses resources on the tiny fraction who show deviation. It's not generalized paranoia, it's targeted attention.
The screeners are trained to be conversational, not confrontational. They're not interrogating you, they're chatting with you. The adversarial frame, I'm going to catch you in a lie, catch me, actually makes steps harder and harder to detect, because it raises the stakes and makes both liars and truth tellers more nervous, which muddies the signals.
The everyday sleuth should be more like a curious conversationalist than a detective. Interested, attentive, but not accusatory.
The best interrogators I've read about are like that. They build rapport. They listen more than they talk and talk. They make it easy for the person to tell the truth, not hard to tell the lie. Because ultimately, most people want people to tell the truth. The truth is cognitively cheaper. If you create a situation where the truth is welcome, then deception becomes the harder path.
The people who still choose the hard path under those conditions, those are the ones worth paying attention to.
The signal emerges from contrast. If your adversary overfits with everyone, then there's no contrast. Everyone looks stressed. Everyone looks guarded. You destroy your own baseline.
To wrap this into something actionable, establish baselines in low-stakes settings, ask open-ended questions, and listen for structure and texture. Withhold what you know until you've heard the narrative. Pay attention to clusters of behavioral change rather than single cues. Test your own accuracy with real feedback, and approach the whole thing with genuine curiosity rather than suspicion. That's the everyday toolkit.
Except you'll still be wrong a lot, but 54% is the professional baseline for a reason. The goal is to become a human polygraph, is to be a little more perceptive than you were yesterday, and humble enough to know the difference.
I think that's the right note. You don't graduate from this, you just pay better attention. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The word diatomaceous traces back to the early medieval period when scribes in what is now the Yukon first encountered a crumbly white deposit they called Frostshock, believing it was condensed moonlight that had fallen to earth and petrified. It was, of course, fossilized diatom shells.
That's almost poetic.
Frostshock is actually a great name. They were wrong, but they had style. This has been a weird one. Our producer is Hilbert Blumenthal. If you enjoy this, just leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. I'm Orin Corn. I'm Herman Alberman Pelberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.